today on Against the Grain, what effect can invoking human dignity and the need to respect dignity have on mass incarceration and militarized policing? Jonathan Simon says, quite a lot. I'm CS. The Berkeley Law professor advocates for a dignity-based struggle to change the direction of the carceral state, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. What kind of policing and punishment system do we have here in the U.S.? In the eyes of Jonathan Simon, we have a system that is, quote, as degrading as any that has been produced inside a liberal democracy and comparable to that of illiberal states like apartheid South Africa. Well, what can we do about that? We can propose reforms, we can alter specific practices, but according to Simon, we need a concept, a principle, to guide and inform efforts to address mass incarceration and repressive policing. That concept, Simon believes, is dignity. He argues for a rule that says, no crime and no punishment without respect for human dignity. Invoking that concept and applying that rule would, he has argued, constitute a promising avenue for confronting what he calls America's distended and degrading penal state. Jonathan Simon is professor of law at UC Berkeley School of Law. His books include Governing Through Crime, How the War on Crime Transformed American Democracy and Created a Culture of Fear, and Mass Incarceration on Trial, A Remarkable Court Decision and the Future of Prisons in America. To a new volume entitled The New Criminal Justice Thinking, he has contributed a chapter called The Second Coming of Dignity. When Jonathan Simon joined me recently in studio, I asked him to begin by describing another principle, the so-called legality principle.
The legality principle is sometimes talked about like it was an inside baseball concept for criminal law professors and students. And there it is often treated as something you deal with in the very beginning of the course, where you notice that to be a criminal law, it has to be something that the lawmaking authority, the legislature, the parliament, has described as a crime before anybody could charge you with that crime. And we sometimes describe that as the constitutional principle that you can't be punished for anything unless it is already a crime, already against the law before you did it. In other words, you can't do it ex post facto. In a very famous, for the 20th century, perhaps the most famous example of what you should not do was when the Nazis punished a man they convicted of setting fire to the Reichstag right after Hitler came to power. Historians now believe he actually did it. At the time, lots of people thought it was a setup because the Nazis used it as an excuse to basically increase their power. But at the time, German law did not allow the death penalty for arson, and nobody was killed. So they just changed the law and said, well, now we can have the death penalty for arson, and they executed him. And for them, it was a great example of their new idea of sort of the German folk as the source of law. But for the last couple hundred years, we've been trying to think about law in very different terms, not as a free-floating spirit of the people or the king, but as the deliberate, willful acts of a legitimate sovereign authority. And behind this move is something much more important than just criminal law, and that is the idea that there is a consolidated nation state. It may be a democracy, it may be a constitutional monarchy or even a dictatorship, but that legal authority emanates from a principled locus of legal power. And whatever the source of that sovereignty is, it has to act first before the criminal law can be used to justify punishment. Historically, this basically develops at the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, as what we now know as the criminal justice system is coming into shape and being reformed under the theme of responsibility in the nation state. If a citizen is being punished, it's not because the king just wants to vent his fury on the citizen. The citizen is being punished because the citizen has disobeyed the duly enacted laws that they should have obeyed. And that becomes very important to our core theories of why punishment is legitimate. It's legitimate because you deserve to be punished for violating your promise, the social contract idea, and because we need to have a credible threat in order that people won't violate the promises that they have made to the law. Those are kind of the core legitimacy principles of punishment in the West, and they depend on this idea.
So the nutshell expression of the legality principle is, and I'm reading from your chapter here, no crime and no punishment without law?
Correct.
So are you arguing that the legality principle should be dispensed with?
Well, not exactly. So in addition to the idea that it's not a good idea to punish people retroactively for things that only became crimes after they did them, that that's somehow unfair, I think there's been a broader idea associated with the legality principle, which I talk about in the piece, and that is the idea that over time, this connection between the lawmaker and the criminal law is a progressive force, that over time, this will make the law more fair, less severe, more adapted to sort of the long-term interests that the sovereign has in the citizen. And for the last several centuries, in some ways, I argue that the legality principle was a kind of northern star for those seeking to reform the system. So, for instance, in the context of the United States, where many of our injustices in our criminal system tend to be associated with, especially in the past, with local justice, especially in the South, and racist state laws, et cetera, the effort to create a set of national constitutional principles to set limits to what the police could do or what punishment could do is, you could say, a form of the legality principle, an expression that it had, or for Congress to pass laws aimed at establishing national standards, which they've rarely done in the criminal area, but could in principle do. And that's what you see in Europe more, national legislation that does things like ultimately end the death penalty, for instance, as an act of parliament. So I think for many students of the history of criminal law, there was this idea that the legality principle, in addition to being a kind of principle of fairness, was also a pathway to progress. And the reason that it was a pathway to progress was sort of the reason that we think democratic societies become better societies, that nation states seem to be on a path toward greater democracy, greater accountability to their own citizens. And historians have pointed out that, as you, for instance, see the right to vote extended to working class people in Britain at the end of the 19th century, that went along with a whole wave of reforms to make criminal law more fair, less stigmatizing, more procedurally balanced, as if to recognize that the working class citizens who were so often the targets of the criminal law had gained in the worthiness and stature that they had because of the right to vote.
So in other words, democratization inclined representatives in government to protect the rights of their constituents, which included working class and poorer folks.
Exactly. And it's one of the reasons, we see some progress in some ways over time, greater reduction in the use of the death penalty in the 19th century, efforts to make prisons more reformatory at the beginning of the 20th century. The other kind of big force along with democracy is bureaucracy. And the reason bureaucracy is often thought to be associated with progress is the idea that so often cruelty or unfairness in the criminal law is a product of personal whim or the discretion of and appetites of sort of individuals who might be inclined to be tyrannical when they have the power, and that bureaucracies, at least what we were taught by Uncle Max Weber, was that bureaucracies were supposed to sort that out by imposing a grid of transparent rules that would guide us. Now, all of us have spent too much time looking at the actual carceral state to feel much confidence that bureaucracy means leniency over time. But for a long time, it looked like it would work. And as late as the 70s, it looked like one of the big stories about American prisons was that through court-led reform, they were moving from being sort of 19th century satraps to something like a modern bureaucracy with wardens and a Department of Corrections and standards.
So you've been telling me that, there's a kind of progressive direction to the application of the legality principle over time, over the decades and centuries. So isn't that enough? Doesn't that move us far enough along the path of reform for your taste?
Well, I argue in the piece that it turns out that, like a lot of principles, it kind of worked for a period of time and then it stopped working. I think it's one of the truisms I'll lay claim to about human affairs, that instead of having iron laws like they get in physics and whatnot, we tend to have things that work But if you try to claim it as a law, like the end of history, it doesn't work too well because it tends to be very contingent. So I think two things happened on the way to a more just system through the legality principle. One, democracy met its limits as a tool for reform in the form of populist punitiveness. You can have a more and more democratic system which under some circumstances will set restraints on the state's punitiveness, especially when voters identify with the people who are being punished. But as soon as they begin to view themselves as the beneficiaries of tough punishment, as soon as the fear of crime, for instance, rather than the fear of an oppressive state, tends to become the dominant concern, then you can end up with a kind of democratic bidding war to see who can be most punitive and least fair to people in the system. And I think that's what we had in this country from about 1968 on. And I wrote a whole book on it called Governing Through Crime, sort of talking about how crime became a new kind of populist politics. The other thing, which you won't be surprised is goes along with this, is race, basically. Legality and democracy worked pretty well as long as you were being incorporated into the larger whiteness space that was being defined as the real party and interest, right? I mean, going back to Dred Scott versus Sanford, you know, Chief Justice Taney had said that the American people were never intended to include non-whites. Legally, that was overturned in the 14th Amendment. Many of us believe that we've never uprooted that idea enough from our legal and political system. But in any event, African Americans in particular have been the, and many other racialized minorities that, like them, end up being insularly defined as an other and are unable to attain any kind of political alliances sufficient to get them the benefit of a democratic kind of compromise, have ended up becoming a kind of democratic whipping boy for populist punitiveness. So criminologists like to talk about the racial threat hypothesis. And what that basically means is politicians, sheriffs, prosecutors have an incentive to be tough on crime generally, and particularly with African Americans, because it signals to white people that they've got their back and that the law will be on their side. And so that has ended up creating a situation where even to the extent that the legality principle led to some leniency, it didn't help people who are African American. A good example would be drug law. I mean, when I came here to Berkeley as a student in the 70s, a lot of us were celebrating the drug decriminalization of that era by smoking weed out in the streets. Police would ignore it, even though it was technically illegal. But of course, in that very decade, they were getting ready to put tens of thousands of young black men in prison for public drug possession.
Jonathan Simon is his name. He's professor of law at UC Berkeley School of Law and director of the Center for the Study of Law and Society. We are talking about a chapter he contributed about dignity and about how paying attention to respect for human dignity might transform criminal justice in the U.S., a chapter he contributed to the volume The New Criminal Justice Thinking, newly out from NYU Press. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Okay, so the legality principle doesn't cut it. It's not sufficient in your opinion. So what do you want to supplement it with, complement it with, or maybe even replace it with?
Well, I don't want to replace it because I think I'm a lawyer, so I don't want to gut the legality principle. It keeps too many of my students working one way or the other. And I do think it, you know, for all the usual boring arguments about why the rule of law is better than the not rule of law, I think we do need the legality principle. But what I want to suggest in a somewhat colorful metaphor is that if we've been marching under this banner that says legality toward a more just and humane system, that we now need to unfurl another banner, a banner that says dignity on it. Dignity is an interesting term that, you know, has origins even further back than legality and has been developing itself in European and also American legal culture for centuries. But in many ways, it wasn't a necessary supplement to the legality principle until we kind of hit these modern limits on legality. And I think this recent era we've been through of mass imprisonment is so important in sort of reorienting our thinking because it's kind of confronted us with, like I said, the limits of that legality principle. So, you know, notice that if you study the usual history of American criminal justice, the decade or so right before mass imprisonment is one kind of hit parade after another of great civil liberties, civil rights decisions by the Warren Court granting a right to counsel, right to the protection of the Fourth Amendment's warrant requirement, for the first time ever, in some ways, legality is really imposed on local and state criminal justice institutions at the end of the 1960s. And kaboom, what happens next? Mass imprisonment. So, you know, it's sort of, we ran the experiment. We tried to create much more bureaucratic prison systems and much more legalistic criminal courts, and we ended up with mass imprisonment. So we kind of have to admit that we're at the end of that concept. And at the same time, we're confronted with what really got me interested in coming to this issue was confronting how extraordinarily inhumane both our police and our prison system had become despite all of these legal improvements and despite the fact that this was not a problem of poverty or lack of resources. In other words, you know, the cruelty you would have found in prisons in Mississippi or Alabama in the 1920s or 30s or into the 60s or 70s was at least partly due to just the total impoverishment of those states, their unwillingness to spend any money at all on taking care of people in prison. So they had to have other prisoners act as guards and doctors, et cetera. That's not, you know, California, when it was condemned by the Supreme Court in Brown versus Plata as operating prisons unfit for a civilized society, it wasn't doing it because it didn't have enough money or it didn't have enough technology. It's the state of Google, the state of Apple, and the University of California, too. We did it despite all of that modern capacity. And that's why I think essentially only dignity can save us from this kind of descent into inhumanity and indecency on a grand scale.
Now, some people are going to ask, well, what do you mean by dignity? And you refer to a legal scholar named Leslie Henry, who has written about dignity's various meanings over the course of U.S. history. And I wonder if you could kind of go through some of that history, because, you know, obviously we want to understand what you mean by dignity and what value, what dignity value you would like to apply to policing and the penal system today. But give us an historical sense of how those meanings have changed over time, at least according to Professor Henry.
I want to take us to a little deeper arc of history and then to the American Constitution. Professor Henry is studying how the term dignity has been used by the U.S. Supreme Court, which has used it over 900 times since the Constitution was written in 1789, and even though the word dignity does not appear in the Constitution. But it's a word that the framers of the Constitution would have known and would have understood, and it had deep but complex meanings. Indeed, I can't think of a concept that better epitomizes how different meanings can converge over the centuries, because what we think of as dignity today is really an amalgamation of two almost opposite concepts. One comes from the Latin notion of dignitas, and it basically meant the stature and also, therefore, the kind of rights and privileges due to an aristocratic person. A male aristocrat, basically, had dignity. Nobody else did. And not even all of them. It was also thought to be partly a product of valorous behavior in military and other settings. So it was a highly valorized quality of a select few and an extremely hierarchical status-based vision of the world. At the same time, practically, in a somewhat different part of the globe, the Near East, the Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition that we now know was developing a very different concept that in Hebrew, at least, is called Betzalem Elohim, the idea that human beings have an elevated status in creation because they somehow bear the imprint of the Creator in a way that other creatures do not. But notice it's something everybody shares. And while you can have a king or a prophet or a judge in the Bible, they don't have essentially higher status in a sort of existential sense. In God's eye, everybody is the same. So you might think, how did two such crazily different terms come together? And this is what historians like James Q. Whitman, philosophers like Jeremy Waldron have been really interested in, especially the role that the European nation-state played in bringing these two concepts together. Because in Europe, you had two things. You had an aristocracy, dukes and counts and lords, who essentially were the successors of the Latin aristocrats. But you also had a church and the idea that we were all part of some vast, mostly Christian nation that was equal. And of course, you could study how those ideas played with each other over a couple hundred, even thousands of years. But what's really interesting is this. Essentially, in the 20th century, European nation states, in forging the modern idea of citizenship that they had, took the status of aristocrats and distributed it to everybody. It's what some historians call leveling up the population. So notice that terms like monsieur and madame, which are actually aristocratic terms, my lord, my lady, get applied to everybody, right? Mm. You're offended if you're not called monsieur. And in fact, in Europe, it's one of the dignitary rules about prisons, that prisoners get to be called monsieur or herr if they're in Germany, for instance. And so they leveled everyone up. And so you get, by the time you get to, say, the European Convention on Human Rights or some of the stronger dignity-based human rights legal frameworks we have in the world today, you've got the idea that everybody ought to be treated the way we once treated aristocrats. Now, that doesn't mean that everyone gets to order people around or have peasants cut your lawn for you or things of that nature. But it does mean that all of the subjective things that aristocrats came to expect, which are really very important, being treated as if your feelings mattered, as if your subjective state was important to other people. Are you cold? Have you had enough to eat? Think how you treat celebrities when you sometimes meet them. That's how aristocrats were once treated or expected to be treated by everybody. And to some extent, modern dignity means that everybody gets to be treated like that, that everybody should be treated as if their humanity mattered, at least to the government, to the state, right? I mean, many of us walk past other human beings huddled in the cold in the homeless crisis that we're having, and you could say we ignore their humanity routinely. And that's why dignity is mostly about what the state does, because it's one thing when private individuals essentially ignore each other. It's a moral problem. But when the state humiliates its subjects, it has entered into a much more disturbing kind of relationship, which is exactly what dignity tries to protect against.
So this emphasis on equality before the law, that's a good thing, right? I mean, that's a very positive and progressive development.
Absolutely. And, you know, in the aftermath of World War II, in a move that I think of as kind of a dignity cascade. It's a phenomena that I think we can see happen, at least occasionally in history, when a larger entity, a nation or a whole series of countries engages in sort of large-scale violations of their own human values on the deepest level. It can sometimes produce a cascade where, in response, they actually advance those values or take steps to make them clearer, more expansive, and more protective. And we saw a great example of that in the aftermath of World War II when, you know, all the remaining nations, including future enemies, the Soviet Union and the United States, signed the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which put dignity right at the center. And especially in contrast to the horrors of the Nazi regime and the violence of the war, the two things that they really wanted to kind of embrace around the theme of dignity was the equality of all people and essentially the importance of liberty or the right to freedom, especially in the aftermath of the totalitarian settings. And so in the 1950s and 60s in the United States, these ideas of dignity, actually stemming directly from the Universal Declaration, began to influence both law and policy. An early case where we can see this is Trope versus Dulles, a fascinating 1958 case in which Chief Justice Earl Warren held that the United States could not strip citizenship from a soldier who had deserted during World War II, even though that was a lawful punishment, and even though actually death was a possible punishment. But they found that stripping citizenship would deprive people of something essential to their human rights, the very right to have rights, Chief Justice Warren wrote. And interpreting the Eighth Amendment, which prohibits cruel and unusual punishment, he opined, perhaps the real meaning of this amendment is human dignity. And so we get this very striking moment of sort of recognition of human dignity. But I try to argue in the chapter that in some ways this framing around equality and around liberty has real limits, especially as a reform tool when it comes to issues of criminal justice. And I'm happy to talk more about it. But some of the examples of things that changed or policies that were pursued in this period in the name of dignity as liberty and dignity as equality include things like we pretty much ended our system of public mental hospitals. We had a kind of mass incarceration of people in mental hospitals. And most people would agree that those hospitals were an affront to human dignity. They often held people with no treatment and with no real reason that they needed to be confined. But of course, the resulting absence of effective tools for community mental health has led to what many of us consider a great perversion of that goal, which is many people living with the symptoms of mental illness in states of economic deprivation have found themselves incarcerated in prisons and jails. So it's sort of the ultimate irony that in the name of liberty, people are left to be judged harshly against our criminal law and then often abandoned to prisons which don't provide them treatment at all. Another example was actually determinate sentencing. California was a good example of a state in the 50s and 60s that had indeterminate sentences for serious crimes based on the theory that we were going to rehabilitate people. So if you were convicted of a burglary or robbery, you would get a sentence like 6 months to life. And the idea was you had to be rehabilitated before they would release you. California abandoned that system in the mid-70s under then-Governor Jerry Brown, largely because many critics felt that that system denied human dignity in the form of equality, that it treated people not based on the crime they committed or the harm they did, but based on some expert assumption about their individualized problems or needs. And many people rightly feared it was being used against people of color in particular, that their motivations were always viewed as more criminal or their conduct less rehabilitated than more privileged prisoners. So, you know, ironically, we then ended up with a system that in the name of equality and treating everybody with dignity was all set to unload, you know, what became a historic a blizzard of extremely harsh criminal laws on the public.
His name is Jonathan Simon. He joins me in studio. He's Adrian A. Cragen, Professor of Law at UC Berkeley School of Law. He's author of Mass Incarceration on Trial, A Remarkable Court Decision in the Future of Prisons in America, and Governing Through Crime, How the War on Crime Transformed American Democracy and Created a Culture of Fear, among other books. I'm C.S. Song, and you are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. What happened to dignity beginning in the mid-1970s?
So yes, it's a really interesting transformation, I think, of dignity. I mean, if we're looking at the carceral state itself, which was being reformed in some ways by the first wave of dignity, it looks pretty awful. What you see is, you know, a rise of mass imprisonment, courts kind of getting out of the business of trying to enforce constitutional rights that had been talked about in terms of dignity. So there's a kind of a dignity erosion or a dignity latency that seems to settle in over the criminal justice system. But at the same time, dignity is growing rapidly in the culture and evolving. And it's one of the things that fascinates me about it today is that you see it developing in so many areas. So, you know, if you kind of asked somebody just on the street outside our studio here what they thought about when you said dignity to them, a lot of people would talk about things like same-sex equality and marriage. Dignity's become almost a watchword for the right of people to pursue the kind of intimate lives that they wish without having the state, you know, make those kinds of judgments. Another place you see it and hear it is in the care of people at the end of their lives and whether they should have hospice or whether have control over what kind of drug medication they receive for pain. And while these seem like very different areas, I think we can see a couple of broad, you know, categories that have emerged that are very important to dignity today. So one is, I think, most associated perhaps with the same-sex intimacy rights and the right to marriage is the notion of essentially dignity as the ability to have a fulfilling and meaningful life. I think the LGBT community and the trans community have given that a real vividness, as has the disability rights movement. It's helped us see, for instance, that it's not just a question of negative liberties of being left alone. Often, if people are left without sort of meaningful efforts, for instance, to make the environment friendly to the disabled, then individual liberty doesn't have much meaning. So it's a notion of dignity that actually involves government having a role to enable people. For instance, marriage is about enabling people to establish the kinds of intimate relations that they want. So it's not the kind of negative liberty view that I think dignity as liberty had when we were mostly interested in taking the state out of the business of people. It has a much more positive side. The other side to it, which I think has had extraordinary significance in sort of the field of old age care, of medical care, is what you might think of as sort of the dignity of the human body in its existential condition, right? I mean, part of the post-war sort of liberty and equality dignity was very associated with the idea of rationality. The idea that, you know, the reason humans have dignity is they're rational actors And there was a lot of focus on the importance of that to why they should be allowed to be free, but also why they deserve to be punished, for instance, if they choose to act wrongly. This new kind of dignity, which you see very much emerging in humanitarian law around concerns of human rights, refugees, is very concerned with the plight of human beings in the very things that we might think of as sort of not governed by rationality, the degree to which we have bodies that go through suffering that we can't always control, the fact that we have a life course, that we are not the same person at 16 as we are at 26, at 56, et cetera, that we go through changes, that we have unique experiences like giving birth. When you look at an issue like shackling women in prison in birth, you get to the heart of a sort of contemporary dignity issue, even though from the point of view of dignity as liberty or equality, that wouldn't surface at all, because you would say, well, this person gave up their liberty when they committed a felony, and they're being treated just like everybody else who has the same circumstances. We wouldn't get to that at all. But when we see dignity as a way of respecting the humanity of people's own kind of belonging to their body and having to bear up with that when it's a source of great pain and challenge, and also to experience the meaning and pleasure that can come from, you know, ownership and authorship of that body. So I think these are really exciting ways of expressing dignity, partly because they're so broad, but as I think you can imagine, partly because I think they have extraordinary and direct implications for our criminal justice system in ways that are surprising in some ways.
Jonathan Simon, professor of law at UC Berkeley School of Law. We'll take a short break and speak more with Jonathan about the chapter he wrote, and this is based on a lot of work he's done on the question of dignity and how paying attention to respect for human dignity can change the penal system in perhaps radical ways. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Jonathan Simon teaches law at UC Berkeley. He directs the Center for the Study of Law and Society at UC Berkeley School of Law. He's the author of Poor Discipline, Parole and the Social Control of the Underclass, and Mass Incarceration on Trial. And I found a very interesting essay he wrote on the dignity principle and how it might apply and how it is applying to the current system in the U.S. of policing and penality. The chapter was contributed to the volume The New Criminal Justice Thinking, edited by Sharon Dolovich and Alexandra Natapoff, and published by NYU Press. So I think what you've been doing is elaborating on what you call in this chapter, dignity as personal integrity. And you also refer to a more collectively focused kind of dignity called dignity as collective virtue, which you have also seen as perhaps being on the rise or even being expressed in certain decisions recently of the U.S. Supreme Court. What is dignity as collective virtue?
So, you know, when you read the constitutional language about dignity, it often is in play with words that seem related but are hard to exactly pin down. So one of those is the idea of decency or a decent society. So what do we really mean when we say we want a decent society? I and other philosophers that I've drawn from have made the argument that one way of understanding what dignity is the opposite of what comes into being when people are humiliated. When people are humiliated, they're, in the words of the philosopher Avishai Margalit, they're given good reasons to believe that they're not of the same human status as other people in their presence. And that can really be very specific depending on, you know, the nature of the society you're in. So if you're in a society where nobody votes, for instance, the fact that you're a prisoner and you're not allowed to vote doesn't necessarily humiliate you. everybody's in that position. But if you're in a society where everyone votes and only prisoners can't vote among adults, then that's humiliating. And you might say a decent society would respect the right of prisoners to vote. So what I want to suggest is that we think of dignity as personal integrity, as describing the way in which the two themes I was talking about, sort of the right to sort of pursue meaning through intimate relations with others and the exalted nature that we should recognize of the human nature's bodily qualities, the fact that it's not our mind and our rationality alone that makes us kind of stand out as creatures. It's the fact that we have these bodies that we have to live with that cause all kinds of pain and challenges to us, that when people bear up under that, it gives them an exalted quality that the system ought to recognize. Both of these come together in this idea of personal integrity and decency. A decent society is a society whose state is concerned with preserving the personal integrity of its citizens, and especially a society is where the state does not humiliate its citizens by allowing them or even causing them to lose their personal integrity. And that's why I think this new way of thinking about dignity is so important for when we think about police and prisons. So let's just for a moment go back to the old equality, liberty form of dignity. When you look at prisons through the lens of equality and liberty, it doesn't really help very much. It's possible that people are in prison who didn't really commit any crimes, in which case they shouldn't be deprived of their liberty. That would be a wrongful conviction. It's possible that they're being discriminated against by the courts. That would be unequal, and we can try to fix that. But a lot of people have argued that, you know, mass imprisonment happened despite having less discrimination in our courts and despite having, you know, more resources and better efforts to fix problems along the way. And so part of the problem there is if you're sending people to prison for crimes that they've committed, it's easy to square that with the idea of dignity as liberty and equality. You can say we're respecting their liberty. In fact, Kant famously said when somebody commits a murder, they're killing themselves. When we execute them, we're actually giving them their will. We're giving them what they chose to do. And from a quality perspective, prisons are typically miserable for everybody. You know, there may be unequal treatment in prison, but by and large, there's a misery, an equality of misery. So dignity in those tones doesn't really offer much help in thinking about prisons. But when we think about prisons from the perspective of personal integrity and decency, I think they really come to life because the very nature of being in prison is to be put in a situation where one's personal integrity is at risk, where one's capability of maintaining one's humanity is under challenge. And a decent society, if it's going to put people in prison at all, and that's an open question, I think, that we have to come to, is going to have to do so in a way that's committed to preserving their personal integrity.
Well, on the issue of prisons and prison conditions and violations of prisoner and inmate dignity in carceral settings, the U.S. Supreme Court case of Brown versus Plata, which was decided in 2011, is a very significant and important decision in your eyes. How so? And again, this had to do with the Supreme Court understanding and realizing and acknowledging that California has overcrowded and under-resourced prisons and that something had to be done about them.
So I think what was so remarkable about the Plata case and why I continue to believe that it can be a beacon for more change in the courts, but also for political demands for a more decent and dignified justice system, is that it brought together a lot of the features we've been talking about. So you mentioned sort of the epic overcrowding. California was operating a prison system at about 200% of capacity. And it wasn't because we didn't have money or technology. It was really because our zeal to protect ourselves by locking people up grossly exceeded our willingness to pay for it. So even though we built 25 new prisons in the 80s and 90s, we ended up having literally thousands of prisoners sleeping in irregular cots and bunk beds that were set up in hallways and gymnasia and stuff like this. At the same time, we had accumulated a prisoner population that was experiencing a great deal of mental and physical illness, partly a product of expanding the prison population to more drug users, more people who are really lifestyle, people suffering lifestyles of poverty and deprivation that go along with chronic illness as sort of a correlate. So we produced this vast prison population. We didn't think about them as needing treatment or medical help. We saw them only as threats. So we built prisons that were, even if they weren't overcrowded, were way under capable of treating people humanely. So this really came to a head in this case. And what's interesting about it is that the court essentially conceded these people are all here for crimes that are valid crimes. We're not objecting to California's decision to try to incapacitate them. What we're seeing, though, is that you're holding people in conditions where their humanity is in danger, not just their legal status or their rights, but their very ability to be a human being through having physical and bodily integrity. And therefore, your status as a decent society is in question. The memorable terms that Justice Kennedy used in his opinion was that prisons that deny people basic elements of human dignity like medical care have no place in a, quote, civilized society. That sounds very kind of polite, but in legal language, he's basically calling California a barbaric society, and he's a Californian, so I think he really took it to heart. So it the case itself, the factual record, sort of brought dignity as personal integrity and decency as respecting personal integrity right to the forefront. The justices were shown photographs of cages where psychotic prisoners were stripped naked and held to prevent them from committing suicide. And you could hear them in the oral argument just morally outraged at this. And in fact, they were saying, you can punish people severely, maybe even sentence them to death, but you cannot deny their humanity in the way that these routine practices did. So it brought together the sort of picture of dignity that we've been trying to sketch here in a very vivid way. It combined it with the strongest reaffirmation of dignity as a legal concept that we've seen in 20 or 30 years. Justice Kennedy wrote, again, 5-4, but in very strong language, that he said, he doesn't say perhaps, he said dignity animates the Eighth Amendment's cruel and unusual punishment principle. You know, it's hard to think of a term more powerful than animating. If something animates something, it brings it to life, it infuses every aspect of it. And then the final thing is, this court decision affirmed, you know, a decision by the special three-judge court below that ordered California, for all practical purposes, to end mass incarceration. Basically, we had to reduce our prisoner population so large, in such a large amount, that only a change in laws that would end mass incarceration would begin to accomplish it. And while we're not all the way there, the realignment has taken us away from the kind of permanent growth pattern that we were in for a long time. So that kind of trifecta of bringing the reality of inhumanity before the eyes of a public that I think had been blind to it, tying that to dignity as a legal obligation that is constitutional, and finally instrumentalizing that to legal orders that could really change the direction of our carceral state, that's a pretty important moment and a pretty important role for a court that for a long time had really been facilitating mass imprisonment.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Jonathan Simon is Adrian A. Cragen Professor of Law at UC Berkeley School of Law and Director of the Center for the Study of Law and Society. How might dignity-driven reform happen, or maybe you could tell me it already has happened, in the area of police dealing with suspects and doing the kinds of searches and seizures that the Fourth Amendment addresses, the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution addresses?
So yes, policing, I think, is maybe the other area that's most open to new scrutiny and reform when we sort of put on our dignity lenses. And let me just take everybody to a moment that all of us, I think, can remember vividly, and that's the killing of Mike Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and the resulting sort of rise up of the Black Lives Matter movement in response to it. Many people refer to that as, you know, an incident in which Mike Brown was killed by the police, as if that was the only trigger. But in fact, killings by the police of young men of color, you know, happens all the time. And so what made that such a signal event? I think if you go back and actually look at the coverage of it, you'll see that it was leaving Mike Brown's body in the sun for 4 hours by the police, uncovered, while his neighbors and Met family members saw it. That was the most powerful instance. And there may have been justifications for shooting Mike Brown. There were no justifications for degrading his body by leaving him out there. They were, whether they intended to or not, they were sending a message to his entire community that they didn't consider him a human being and they didn't consider them worthy of decent treatment. And I think that was one of the things that made Ferguson so powerful. It's like people can tolerate, and at times, a violent carceral state that they think are protecting their safety. But once they see them as indifferent to the humanity of people. Once that is actually exposed, I think it's really hard to unsee that, hard to put that back in the bottle. And when we start looking at policing from that perspective, what we begin to see is that maybe even compared to prisons, there's almost no aspect of modern policing that doesn't raise real concerns. So what is the most common kind of encounter that citizens tend to have with the police today? Well, you mentioned it, I think, and that's stop and frisk, very controversial. Since the 60s, in order to fight crime, police have been encouraged to not to wait to be called, but to stop people that they believe are behaving suspiciously, confront them, and attempt to identify evidence of crime. And this typically also takes the form of a physical frisk. A person is often pushed up against a wall. The police officer uses their hands to go over the body of the person to see it. The purpose is to identify weapons. Now, you know, stop and frisk can be justified in terms of crime control, in terms of identifying suspicious behavior, in terms of protecting police officers. But whatever its justifications, it's just undeniable if you see one, and you can watch them online very easily, that they fundamentally disrespect people's dignity. To be an adult human being and have another adult human being physically inspect you with their hands is an inherently degrading treatment. I'm not saying that it can never be done or that we can't accept it. Many of us, I go through TSA lines, I seem to set off something, so I pretty routinely get rubbed down. But I also understand why it's happening. Usually the TSA officers are extremely polite and make an effort to explain to me why this is happening. That's not what tends to happen when the police roll up on young men of color. They tend to jump out. They tend to often throw them up against walls. If we look at the arrest process in the United States, about 12, 13 million people a year are arrested. And all too often, it's a violent and degrading experience. Look what happened to Sandra Bland. Her suicide, if that's what it was, is likely caused by the psychological trauma of the way she was arrested by the police. So if we think about dignity as a central value, if the Fourth Amendment, which protects us against unreasonable searches and seizures, is really intended to protect us against being degraded, then I think we have to acknowledge that our Fourth Amendment jurisprudence has really fallen short. And Justice Sotomayor has given voice to this in her recent dissent in the Strife case, where she talks about degrading treatment. She talks about the carceral state. She talks about people being stripped. And she really invokes the importance of dignity as a core value. And again, she was writing in dissent, so we don't have a majority necessarily on the Supreme Court. But I think it kind of highlights the issue and why so many in this rising generation are looking at the carceral state with new eyes and are no longer willing to tolerate such routine degrading treatment of their neighbors.
So, Jonathan, some people might have tuned into this interview in the middle and not really have heard the arc of your argument. So could you, for those people, kind of sum up what you are advocating for in this chapter on dignity in this volume?
I think as more and more Americans seem to be agreeing that our criminal justice system, or the carceral state, as I prefer to call it, is badly out of line with our values as a society and what we really want from our institutions, we need to have ideals. We need to have values that can actually guide us going forward in not just what we don't want, but what we want. And it seems to me dignity is a concept for our time that can do a lot of work for us in helping us understand what we want. For one thing, it can help us understand why we would have a criminal law at all. After all, we have lots of legal mechanisms we can use to try to change people's behavior through civil law. Why do we criminalize certain things? And I think many of us believe that the things that seem to call for criminalization are things that affront other people's human dignity. It's when we violate people's dignity in a core way. And the kind of crimes that people end up talking about in criminal law classes, like rape and murder, robbery, even exemplify that, but don't exemplify the reasons we send people to prison, which tend to be for these crimes of technocracy, you could say. So I think we need to look at dignity to define what we want from the criminal law. It's one of the reasons that hate crimes has emerged as an important area. So it can help us understand why crime at all. It can help us understand what it is that should limit then how we treat people who we've decided need to be punished because they've committed crimes. Because if we're talking about things like rehabilitation or deterrence or even retribution, the kind of classical grammar of criminal law purposes, it's very hard to agree on what's too much and what how we should limit this. And we not only are infamous around the world for having people on death row, which very few other industrialized democracies do, and having lots of people in life sentences, we have tons of people serving 10, 15, 20-year sentences for all kinds of crimes, some serious, some not so serious, but which really are holding people for longer pieces of their lives than can ever really be justified by the value it serves for us. So we really need to find a framework that will help us think about what those limits should be. And I believe that respecting people's human dignity as a core legal principle could help us do that. We can kind of look at our current practices, and I think we would notice right away kind of the low-hanging fruit. And I'll just name some of the things. So if you follow somebody through the criminal process, you'll see that the way they're confronted by the police and arrested is usually deeply degrading. Their experiences in jail is deeply degrading. Most people in their first 24 to 48 hours in jail may have to defecate and urinate in front of 18 or 25 other people with as little as a few inches between them and those other people. It sounds kind of embarrassing to talk about, but a private bathroom is one of the most important technologies, if you will, of human dignity. It's very hard to maintain your dignity when you're defecating in front of 18 people. When we keep people in prison for years, we are disrespecting their human dignity because it's almost impossible to put lives together again. So as we look around, and of course, when we get to the death penalty, we've known for a long time that you can't both execute somebody and say that you're respecting their human dignity. So I wouldn't say that dignity is a one-word, blueprint for reforming everything that's wrong with our carceral state. But I do think it would take us a long way. And the really interesting thing about it is that when you begin to change things with the goal of highlighting people's humanity, you actually deepen your understanding of what their human needs are. You know, Ruth Gilmore has this point when she talks about the difference between what she calls abolition reforms and what she calls reform reforms. And she says, abolition reforms are reforms that make people incarcerated more human, have more access to their humanity, more resources to express their humanity. And one of the benefits of that is once their humanity is more visible, is more on the surface, it's harder for correctional officers to ignore it. It's harder for judges to ignore it. So you get a virtuous circle instead of a vicious circle. You know, if you want to see the vicious circle, watch this documentary on the Stanford Prison Experiment. You can start with the most privileged prisoners and guards in the world, and you still end up with dehumanization within days. But you can also have virtuous circles where people confront the humanity of other people that they've locked up, and they begin to change how they're relating to them because they can't ignore that humanity.
Jonathan Simon, Adrian A. Cragen, Professor of Law at UC Berkeley School of Law. His books include Mass Incarceration on Trial and Governing Through Crime. We've been talking about a chapter he contributed to the volume, The New Criminal Justice Thinking, edited by Sharon Dolovich and Alexandra Natapoff. Jonathan, thanks so much for joining me today.
It's been a real pleasure.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.